All right, we're back. We're back with Max. So, Max, are you there, mate?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hey, Max, how you going?
I'm good.
Good stuff.
Thanks for joining us, brother.
We were just mentioning how we're changing platforms next week because we don't enjoy this convoluted way of having our guests join us, and we prefer to have a smoother introduction to the show, but you're here now and we're ready to rock.
I've always had a reasonable amount of difficulty joining onto Blog Talk Radio. I don't know why, but it's never been easy for me.
They don't make it easy.
No, they don't. I think their setup is bullshit, to be honest. yeah, we won't have to deal with that any longer after this episode, so you're the lucky last on that front, Max.
Oh, there you go.
So, mate, obviously tonight the focus was going to be Palestine, and you were recently, I know you know a lot about it, and you've got a lot of personal, direct, first-hand personal knowledge of the situation over there in Gaza. And we know you recently were over there with Ken O'Keefe, who's a very vocal advocate of the rights of the Palestinian people at large, and he's really fantastic at tearing apart the Zionist media and the Zionist puppets in the media. Where would you like to start with that? We'd love to hear about your trip over there, for one thing, that's for sure.
Well, look, that was actually back in 2012 that I went over there with Ken. So it was a couple of years ago. I've related the story quite a few times. I'm actually going back there again in 10 days. I'm going back to Gaza. I'm going on... should be October the 15th. I should be actually entering Gaza Strip. I'm going to be there for a month this time. Going over there to make a documentary. So that should be interesting. But, it's a dreadful situation that we see over there, and it's something that the world really needs to pay attention to. It's basically a modern day version of the Warsaw Ghetto, Gaza Strip. It's a prison camp. It's not a war zone like people think. I mean, Israel going to war with these people. It's not a war. It's a slaughter. It's a refugee camp full mainly of children. And it's basically ethnic cleansing Israel's been carrying out against these people for the last 67 years. And it just sort of cooks up whatever excuse it can to go in there and kill more of them any time it can. And it calls it a war every time it does. It says, oh, the terrible people in Gaza have been firing rockets into Israel. Usually they're just retaliating to the constant attacks that Israel sends their way. And when they've had enough, they respond, and then Israel cries victim and goes in and carpet bombs them and says they're defending themselves against terrorists. And really they're not. I mean, they've been carrying out brutal acts of terrorism against the people in Gaza and the people in Palestine in general for the last 67 years, and that's really the situation. It's all completely backwards to what people are presented with by the mainstream media. It's truly disgusting, really, the way the media portrays the situation over there.
Yeah, absolutely. What we're presented with is a total inversion of what's going on. And your presentation at Jeff's event was quite interesting. I saw you had a lot of photos. And, for example, you had some photos of these rockets, these infamous rockets we hear about endlessly in the media. What have you got to say about the rockets being fired out of Gaza?
The Qassam rockets. Look, these are basically like drain pipes powered by fertilizer. They're just metal pipes powered by fertilizer. They're skyrockets. They don't explode. There's no ordnance in the ends of them. They're unguided. They're just skyrockets that you shoot up in the air and they land where they will. And they'll kill you if they land on your head. You know, they might put a hole in your roof. They'll smash the back window of your car, but they won't blow anything up. And Israel responds with 500-pound bombs into residential buildings. I mean, it's ridiculous. And the fact that they're using these hopeless little rockets, I mean, it shows, what underdogs these people are. They're virtually fighting with sticks and stones against one of the most powerful military organizations on earth. But you've got to wonder who sends them over all the time. I mean, these rockets don't do anything. They don't kill anybody. They can't reach Tel Aviv. They can't reach anywhere major. So what's the point of sending them over there? Well, one thing is it does show that the people of Palestine won't back down, no matter, even if they're stuck with sticks and stones. But it also gives Israel the perfect excuse it needs to cry victim and carry out bombing raids against these people all the time. So you got to wonder about the whole rocket thing. I mean, I really wonder about it. I can see both sides, but I can see that it does serve a purpose from the Palestinian perspective, saying that they'll never back down. But again, it provides a perfect excuse for Israel. So I really wonder about the whole rocket program. But they're not a threat. I mean, they're not a threat at all. And the people of Israel are as terrified by these things as anybody. I mean, the people of Israel are as terrorized by their own government as what the people in Gaza are, simply because of the amount of air raid sirens and, you know, they're always screaming, rocket attack, and, you know, you've got these old ladies who've got to hobble down flights of stairs and go and hide in the bunkers and things from these rockets that will never hit them. They'll never cause any damage. So, you know, these people are programmed and they're as terrorized by their own government as the people in Palestine. So it's a two-way street, really.
It's a pretty powerful social engineering, man. I mean, I don't know exactly what happens, but presumably they have, you know, the siren or something that goes off alerting people that a rocket's been fired, or, you know, everyone has to duck for cover. I mean, if you're doing that every day, that's a powerful form of brainwashing.
Well, it is. And that's what the people in Israel are subject to all the time. They're terrified by the... I mean, they truly believe they're under attack all the time, and they're not. I mean, most of the attacks come from the other side. Israel's constantly attacking Gaza Strip. It's constantly carrying out ethnic cleansing and bulldozing of homes and stuff in the West Bank. So it's constantly attacking the Palestinian people. And whenever they respond, Israel screams victim at the top of its voice and literally terrorizes its own people by believing, you know, making them believe the attack is 10 times worse than what it actually is. And it's not an attack anyway, it's defense. I mean, Palestine's never attacked Israel because Israel is an invading aggressive force. All Palestine's ever done is defend itself against Israel. Israel's the attacker, it always has been.
Yeah. It's interesting. I read President or ex-President Jimmy Carter's book on that subject, and it was quite interesting how candid he was about, you know, who's in the right and who's in the wrong here. And he was quite blatant that Israel is the source of the real source of the problem here. I don't know if you've read his book on the subject, but it was quite enlightening coming from, you know, that position of someone who's, you know, normally so, you know, sort of controlled and puppeteered. He was quite open and candid as an ex-president writing his own book.
Well, yeah, I mean, Israel's been the aggressor ever since day one. I mean, Israel was founded on terrorism with the bombing of the King David Hotel back in 1948, or whenever it was, and it's been that way ever since. And if you can look back way through, Theodore Herzl's diaries, back as far back as 1895, when he was talking about the need to basically ethnic cleanse all of Palestine, you know, that Israel will never be secure while there are Palestinians living in Palestine. And they're going to have to displace all of the people and just basically shift them out and slowly and discreetly shift them out of the country so that there aren't any Palestinians living within the boundaries of Palestine. They talk about it way back then. It's been the agenda ever since day one. And that's why they've always been the aggressor. But they cry victim. It's very, very clever, the manipulation and control of the media. And they're always presenting themselves as the victims, but they're not. They've been the aggressor ever since day one, and it's not going to stop until they've ethnically cleansed the entire place. That's why the peace process never works. I mean, we hear about all these peace talks between Israel and Palestine, and we hear that the Palestinians need to acknowledge Israel's right to exist, but the problem is that Israel will not acknowledge Palestine's right to exist. And you even hear President Obama saying he believes Israel has a right to defend itself. Well, no problem. But does Palestine have the right to defend itself? Because it should have the same rights that Israel has, shouldn't it? But they don't ever acknowledge Palestine. It's never part of the peace process. They don't really acknowledge that it exists. So there's the problem right there. You know, it's a double standard right from the word go.
It is.
And for this ethnic cleansing to have gone on for so long and founded, what was this founded upon and why? How did it all start?
The ethnic cleansing of Palestine, how did it start? Well, yeah. when they came there in 1948, it was basically decided that they were going to take over the whole country. The plan was to split West Bank and Gaza Strip apart so that they were separate from each other, and then to eliminate Palestine from the maps, eliminate the word Palestine from the maps, and then they can just basically, over a couple of generations, they can convince people that there never was a Palestine. And these are just Arabs that are squatting in Israeli land. And that's what the Israeli people think, which is why it's so difficult to convince these people or talk to these people about the situation. I mean, when the Israeli people tell you that these Palestinians are just riffraff and they're not actually, there was no country called Palestine, they actually believe it. They firmly believe what they're saying. They're programmed to believe this. And it's been going on for 67 years, ever since they came and split the place up and Israel was formed. They've been gradually pushing the Palestinian people out. And it's so difficult to talk to the people about it because of the level of programming that the Israeli people have been subject to. It's absolutely incredible. It's like nothing you've ever seen. It's like a completely different history to the rest of the world, you know. And they believe stuff, and you can sit there and try to debate them about it, and they've got endless books that they'll pull off their shelves, which are all written by the Israeli people, which all tell the same story, you know. And there's literally hundreds of them, thousands of them. So it's a very, very difficult program to break. But they truly believe that there are no Palestinian people. One of the arguments they have is that, well, if there was a Palestine before we came along, tell me who, name one Palestinian government or one Palestinian leader. That's one of the arguments they use. And of course, you can't give them any because there were no Palestinian governments or leaders. But by that same argument, I would say, well, you could use that same argument to say that there was nobody in Australia before the British arrived, because there was Australian government or Australian leader was there. There were 30 nations that lived here. But there was no government or leader. They were a nomadic people, you know, and it's the same as Palestine. There was no government or leader. There was no administration because you didn't really need one. Now, the whole Arab world didn't have any real administration before the British got involved. And if you look at the Arab world, the lines on the maps in the Arab world, you look at the divisions between all of the Arab countries, these are all drawn with a ruler. These were all Britain, all these boundaries in place. This was a nomadic region of nomadic tribes for centuries until England got involved and divided the whole thing up and told many of the Arab sheikhs that they were kings and their daughters and sons were princes and princesses and they should all come to Cambridge and get educated. And, you know, then Lawrence of Arabia came out and they created the Suez Canal and all the trade missions and all the stuff that happened. It was England that did that whole thing. So Palestine was just an area that was never really divided the way the rest of the place was because there wasn't any oil there. They didn't need to divide it. There wasn't any resources there that they needed. So it just remained a nomadic region, you know. And then when, you know, so that the European Khazars, the Jews of Europe came down and decided they'd claim the country, and they can quite rightly say, well, name the government that existed before us, and there wasn't one. Of course there wasn't, because there weren't governments in the Arab world before that time. You know, there were in certain parts of the Arab world, but only because England came along and introduced them, you know.
And I think looking from the outsider's perspective, certainly from if one was someone who got all their information from the mainstream media, it's clear that many people who listen to that kind of you might say rubbish, would not even think to look at the people of Israel and see how they've been programmed and the propaganda and all that has gone on for them to be behaving the way that they are. And also to see that these are just people on both sides and they're just innocent human beings that have been lied to. And
well, yeah, they're people that are being programmed. I mean, that's why I really don't agree with the whole let's hate the Jew thing. I mean, I don't hate the Jews. Most of the people in Israel, the Jews in Israel, most of them aren't even Semitic Jews, and virtually all of them are programmed. I mean, all of our societies are programmed. I mean, all Western culture is programmed. It really is. I mean, any culture that believes money's real is programmed. Let's get down to it, you know, if you really want to get down to it, you know, to down to the basics. And so you can't hate these people. I don't hate Jews. I mean, I don't like the system. I really don't like the Israeli system. It's a supremacist apartheid system. I don't like any religious system. I think they're all religious systems are based in apartheid. They're all based in racism. They're all based in supremacism. All of them. You know, they really are. All religious doctrines are. And I don't think that, the Muslim religion has anything, is any better than any other religion. I don't think Christian religion is any better than any other religion. I don't think Judaism is any better. I think they're all as bad as each other. You know, there are good points in all of them, but I think they all have a root of supremacism. I have a great relationship with God, and there's no religion in my life. You know, I don't need religion to get in the way of my relationship with my Creator. And that's a thing, you know. So when you look at the whole Israeli thing, I mean, it's very... I don't agree with the whole blame Jews for everything. I think these people are incredibly programmed. And we've got to try to reach through the programming, because ultimately the problem isn't the Jews. The problem is the Israeli system, which is an apartheid system. And the only people who are going to fix that are the Israeli people. So if you go off on one of these, let's hate the Jews tirades, well, you just alienated all these people. These people are programmed. You can't hate them. How can you hate them? How can you hate people who are programmed to have a false version of reality and to live according to a false version of reality and a false version of history, to believe that they're God's chosen and all the things they believe? You can't hate them for it. It's a doctrine that's been instilled into their minds. You know, a lot of them are good people. You know, you can't hate them. You've just got to try to re-educate people into reality, you know. So, I mean, it's a hard situation to deal with. But I think it's very dangerous to go off on these sort of these rants and raids where you condemn an entire culture or an entire race or an entire religion simply due to the actions of a few, you know.
And there are some pretty vocal Orthodox Jews who are very opposed to what, you know, to the actions of the State of Israel as well.
Well, there are a lot of Orthodox Jews who are very adverse to the actions of Israel. But again, I mean, it's a very supremacist system. The Judean religious system is a very supremacist system. Out of all the religious systems, it is quite a supremacist system. And I can understand why people would say that, say, oh, no, if you believe that, well, you got to be bad. Well, I don't know. I mean, all religions have their seat in supremacism, so... I mean, it takes it a little bit further, but, you know, it's not the Jews that are the problem. The problem is as far as Israel and Palestine goes, the problem is Zionism, not Judaism. It's Zionism. And, Zionism is probably the most anti-Semitic, organization on the planet, the most anti-Semitic belief system on the planet, because Zionism gets away with all of this stuff and the Jews are the ones that get the blame for it, you know?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. The Zionists use the Jewish people as a human shield, if you like.
Well, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It is. It's like human shields, absolutely. Well, religious shields.
Yeah, exactly. And we do, speaking of human shields, we hear a lot of this nonsense about human shields being used in Gaza. Maybe you've got a few comments on that.
Well... Israel uses Palestinian people as human shields all the time. Human shields in Gaza, it's a tricky thing to talk about, because there's no military targets in Gaza. Gaza is a walled-in population of 1.8 million people in an area 25 miles long, 4.5 miles wide. So you've got 3,000 people per square mile. So, I mean... if there's people in here who are sending rockets into Israel and fighting back against Israel, Well, I guess they're in amongst the civilian population, because where else are you going to put them? So,
yeah.
Human shields, are these people human shields because there are fighters in amongst them? I mean, there isn't anywhere in Gaza you can be where there aren't other human beings, you know? So,
yeah.
I mean, human shields, I mean,
semantics.
It's not like they're grabbing people and putting them in front of rockets. It's just that if they put a rocket anywhere, then there's people around there because it's Gaza Strip. It's the most densely populated area on Earth. On the other hand, you do see Israeli soldiers arresting Palestinian children and making them sit on the front of their RVs and making them sit up at the wall with them and making them sit with them while they shoot at Palestinians. And this is legitimate human shields. These are people that are being used as human shields. It's a different way of looking at it. I mean, you know, that in Gaza, there's nowhere you can put anything where there aren't people. So if you're going to call these people human shields simply because there's military ordnance near them, well, it's Gaza Strip. I mean, where can you go where there aren't people? You can't. You know, and if you're fighting back, and really all they've got are these Qassam rockets that we talked about before, and Kalashnikovs, AK-47s, you know, light weapons, hand weapons. You know, there's nothing like what Israel's got. Israel's got a major military force funded by the West to the tune of $7 million a day or something. I mean, it's ridiculous how much weaponry they've got. And these are the ones who are using human shields, and the Palestinians aren't. They definitely wouldn't do anything like that. I mean, but like I said, there's no way you can put any military anywhere in Gaza where there aren't people around anyway. So the whole human shield thing in the context of Gaza Strip, it's a joke. It's a complete joke.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you commented on that, because it's one of those asinine buzzwords you hear a lot in the media when they're trying to demonize the entire people of Palestine.
It's always about the rockets and the human shields. Yeah, that's all they've got, really.
That's all they've got. Oh, the rockets. What about the? Don't you care about the rockets being fired? Come on, rockets. Rockets everywhere.
Well, it's such a threatening word, isn't it? Rocket. You know, rocket. It's not just it's not a grenade. It's a rocket. Sounds terrible, doesn't it? But it's a skyrocket. Well,
You showed us pictures of all the unexploded ones. They don't explode. They just land how they've been made.
Yeah, you showed them on all stacked up together on a shelf somewhere, and you were like, well, if they're so dangerous and so explosive, why are they gathering them up and putting them on the shelf?
Yeah, exactly. You can't go and pick up Israeli bombs and put them on a shelf to show you the bombs they've been sending over, because these things blow up. But the Qassam rockets don't. They're just metal pipes. They don't blow up. So they can gather them all up. They can put them on a shelf, and they can show you all the hundreds of rockets they've sent over there. Oh, gee, that's terribly threatening, isn't it? You know, they're just metal pipes. They've got fertilizer packs in the bottom of them, so they let off a lot of smoke as they fly over the wall, so they look quite threatening. But they don't go anywhere. You can see one coming. You can step out of the way. You know, it puts a black splodge on the road. It doesn't do anything. One guy complained because he had one of them go through the back window of his car. He was terrified. I mean, these aren't, and they say, oh, they're spending billions on rockets. Really? Billions on rockets. They spend billions of dollars on these unguided pipes that can put a hole in the back window of your car. These are billion-dollar ordnance, are they? I mean, you know. And people just lap it up. They just buy, oh, yeah, rockets. Israel has a right to defend itself against thousands of rockets they're sending over. Thousands of them. Really? How many thousands of people have they killed with these rockets? They haven't killed anybody. You know, so, you know, people have really got to put it in perspective, don't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, that's one thing you never hear in the media is the death toll caused by the retaliatory Palestinian rockets versus the death toll from Israel's military attacks.
Exactly. I mean, look at this last conflagration. It was like, what, 3,000 people killed compared to 75 Israelis, you know? And in Operation Cast Lead, there was 13 Israelis killed and 1,300 Palestinians killed. 100 to 1.
Wow.
You know, and yeah. they cry victim all the time. And even in this last, there might have been 3,000 people killed or over 3,000 people killed in this last incursion, and that's the official death toll. You'll find there'll be tens of thousand people that are missing still. But there's also hundreds upon hundreds of permanently disabled children from this last incursion. Because the Gaza Strip is a population that's mainly children. You know, 1.8 million people, over 900,000 children. So you're conducting a war against children, you know. And these children have got Qassam rockets and Kalashnikovs and rocks, and you've got one of the most powerful military forces on Earth. And you're going and dropping aerial bombardment on these people for 51 days, and you dare to call it a war, and you slander them by calling them terrorists because they fight back. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. It's a travesty, and it's a travesty that the funding they receive from the US, and I think Australia sends them money too, I'm not sure on that.
Everyone does.
Everyone.
Yeah. While we're talking about the armour and the military that they have, can you just touch on the weapons that they're using on the ground as well that you were telling us about? Some of them are just absolutely horrific.
Well, yeah, the dime ammunition is one particular weapon which sends out micro shrapnel, which tears the flesh from your bones. It if it doesn't kill you, it maims you terribly, but it doesn't damage the furniture. You know, it sends out like really, really fine, super fine particles of shrapnel, which literally shred your flesh. They use this type of ammunition, which is experimental ammunition. They also use flesh A bombers, which shoot out micro darts. These are little darts that are about like an inch long or 3 inches long, little titanium darts, thousands of them in one little shell, which will just send out shrapnel through the whole room. And again, these weapons maim you horribly if they don't kill you. They also use white phosphorus, which is a banned chemical weapon, which sucks all the moisture out of your body, burns you from the inside out, burns about 1,500 degrees if it lands on your skin. And it sucks all the moisture out of your body. And if you put more water on it, if you pour water or anything on there to stop the burning, it gets worse. And these things are banned chemical weapons. And they say they're not targeting civilians. And yet they explode this dime ammunition, these flesh A bombs in residential buildings. They explode white phosphorus over residential suburbs. But they'll explode this stuff 200 or 300 feet in the air so it blankets the whole suburb. Yeah, it's absolutely shocking. So these are banned chemical weapons. I mean, everything Israel did in this last incursion is a war crime. It blew up schools, blew up ambulances, blew up the waterworks, blew up the power plant. These are all war crimes. You can't blow up the waterworks. You can't blow up the power plant. You can't shell ambulances and schools and hospitals. It did all of this stuff. These are all war crimes. And we have to pay attention to this because, I mean, everything it does there is a war crime. Like I said, it's a modern-day equivalent of the Warsaw Ghetto. It's a walled-in population predominantly of children. And Israel goes in there with a major military force, and it calls it self-defense. And it's ethnic cleansing. That's all it has ever been, is ethnic cleansing. And it's decimated Gaza Strip now to the point where it's virtually unlivable. You know, the people can't live there. It's shocking. You know, they're drinking bottled water. The whole place is polluted. There's bodies and death everywhere, blown up buildings. 11,000 homes destroyed in this last incursion. I mean,
Jesus.
Unbelievable, just unbelievable. 44,000 people homeless or something from this last incursion. Absolutely incredible.
Wow.
So, you know, and it's coming on to winter. They got no water, they got no blankets, they got no food. They destroyed all the crops, all the area where they're growing food, all the market gardens, all this stuff. They always destroy this. Whenever they go in there, first thing they do is they go there and they destroy all the gardens, any of the crops, anywhere they might be able to get food, you know, anything like that. Now, Israel actually, when they were doing the sanctions against Gaza, they actually tallied up the amount of people in Gaza and they worked out how many calories they needed to stay alive. And that's how many calories they would let in there with the aid shipments that go in there every week. I mean, this is pure psychopathy. To actually work out the calories that they need to just barely survive and allow just that amount in, that is absolutely disgusting, you know?
That's, I mean, if any other, you know, so-called country, because it's not a real country, but if any other country was doing that, there would be a universal outcry against it. Everyone would be up in arms.
Yeah, but we can't say anything like that against Israel, because if we do, we're anti-Semitic. Yeah, it's incredible. It's an amazing program they've got running. There's a friend of mine, or an acquaintance of mine, a guy called Gilad Atzmon, and he made a wonderful quote. He said, the real Jewish power is the capacity to silence any discussion about Jewish power. And he's very wrong.
Well, that's what, you know, that's the essence, I guess, of the Zionist control, is the control of the dialectic itself, and they've done a great job of that.
Well, they have, yeah, amazing. It's absolutely incredible.
And if we can go back, I know I said it was recent, but it was a couple of years ago, to your trip with Ken over there. You did a lot of interacting with the people and the children, and you spent a bit of time talking about that at Jeff's event. I'd like to actually, you know, for the audience to hear a little bit of the direct personal interactions you had with the people of Gaza while you were there.
Well, when I went over there, what we did was, while I was there, we built a school room for the Sameni children, because these kids were pretty brutalized in Operation Car Sled. And so we built a school room for them. I got to kind of know a lot of the kids pretty well. And I made a, you know, I made a real connection with a few of them. There was one young girl called Noor who speaks English. And she has no parents, and I made a real connection with her. I'm actually going to feature her in a documentary when I go back there in a couple of weeks. I've got to go back there. I want to make a film over there called Finding Noor. And I'm pretty sure she's still alive. But I want to go and find her, and I want to just document the journey, finding her, document the way the place has changed since I've been over there. But I met a lot of children. I went and spoke at the university. I met some beautiful people at the university as well. I went and visited with the people at the Ministry of Detainees. I mean, Palestine is the only country in the world to have a Ministry of Detainees. This is a government department just to deal with the amount of people that are illegally detained by Israel. When I was over there, there was about 4,600 people in jail while I was over there. Now there's about 6,000 or 7,000 people that are illegally held in Israeli jails without any charge or trial. There's about 600 or 700 children under the age of 18 that are held in Israeli jails without any charge or trial. Just picked up at checkpoints for whatever reason, just because they're Palestinian. And this is the sort of thing that they're subject to. This is the sort of life that they're subject to. But what I met over there were just normal people, everyday people. And it's very difficult to walk down the street. And if you talk to someone for longer than a minute, if you go to a shop and you're talking to someone, if you talk to them for longer than a minute, they're calling for the help to bring out a tray of tea and some cakes. And they want you to sit down and have tea with them and have a drink with them and have something to eat with them. I mean, everywhere you go, they want to feed you and they want to socialize with you. They're the nicest people. They are such nice people. I mean, the Arab part of the world, everywhere that I've gone in the Arab world, these have been the most hospitable and most kindest and most generous people I've ever met, most courteous people I've ever met. And that really says something, you know. And it seems that that's what the West doesn't want. It doesn't want this courtesy. It doesn't want these nice, kind people. I don't know what it is. But this whole Arab menace, this whole Muslim menace that we keep hearing about, I've never experienced it anywhere I've been around the world. I've been to a lot of countries and I've met a lot of people, and I've never met any Muslim menace, and I've never met any unsociable Muslim people. The only Muslim people I've ever met have been incredibly courteous. And that's what I experienced when I was in Gaza. I met some of the nicest people I've ever met. And so many children, just so many children, so many homeless children, so many orphan children, so many children. They're just everywhere, you know. That's why it's so disgraceful to have a war against these people. It's not a war. It's a slaughter. You can't have a war against children. It takes two armies to have a war. It takes two countries to have a war. And Palestine and Israel are not two countries. It's the one country, you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, Israel's not a legitimate country. Palestine's been there for quite a while. And speaking of the amazing hospitality of these people, you actually mentioned in public, Joseph, and I think you might have in other interviews as well, your reception by Hamas.
Yeah, that was interesting. Like we entered their country illegally. We snuck in through a rebel tunnel. It wasn't a normal entrance into Gaza Strip. It was through a rebel tunnel, and it wasn't any of the tunnels that you hear about, these terrible Hamas tunnels. This was kids that dug this tunnel, and they kind of snuck us in there. And then when we were in there, we thought, well, we better tell the world that we're in here. So, yeah, I mean, anything could happen. So we made some videos, posted them on YouTube to let the world know that we were in Gaza Strip. And, of course, Hamas saw the videos, so they came around, knocked on the door the next day and wanted us to come and discuss our presence in Gaza. And we thought, well, that's a pretty good sign. I mean, they didn't kick the door down and arrest us and drag us off. They knocked on the door, and then they asked us, would we please come into the Ministry of Interior the next day to discuss our presence in Gaza? And we did, and they confiscated our passports, and we didn't get them back for 6 days, which was an interesting feeling. But when we did get them back, they gave them back to us about an hour and a half before we had to be at the border to leave. And when we got to the border, we got detained, and they interrogated us for like 5 hours to try to find out how we came in. They wanted to know where the tunnel was. And we wouldn't tell them where the tunnel was. We just basically told them we didn't know. But they gave us tea and bickies and all sorts of stuff. They were very nice to us. They drove us around town. They actually lost our luggage because they detained us for so long that they lost our luggage. And so when they let us go, which was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we actually got to the border about 1. They let us go at about 5, and they said, well, look, because it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon, it's not good for a couple of white guys to be crossing the Sinai by yourself at this hour of the day. So we recommend that you use one of our Hamas drivers to get you back to Cairo. He'll make sure you get through the checkpoints safely. And we'll find your luggage and we'll send it on after with the driver that you've already got here waiting for you. So, yeah, that was my experience with Hamas. They interrogated me by basically giving me a couple of packets of tea and bickies and driving me around town. And then when they provided a driver to get me back to Cairo safely, and they sent my lost luggage after me. So I thought that was pretty good. I mean, if I'd broken into Israel illegally, I'd probably still be in jail, you know. Yeah. And I doubt that, and even if they let me out, I doubt that they would send my lost luggage after me. So they were pretty damn good, considering I'd broken into their country illegally and I just ran around with the country with a video camera for 10 days. I mean, they could have shot me as a spy, but they didn't. They let me go, and they were very kind to me. They were very courteous to me, and it was nice tea and bickies, you know.
What brand were they?
Well, they're kind of wafer biscuits, but they were nice, you know. There's chocolate, strawberry, vanilla wafers, you know. It was good.
Oh, yeah, they're a classic. That's amazing. So this horrific terrorist organization gave you tea and bickies, looked after you, made sure you could travel around safely, provided you a driver, and then found your lost luggage and sent that back to you. I think if Israel and their military and their government facilities acted with half the decency, the situation over there would be dramatically different.
Look, I think if the Australian government was as courteous as my experience with Hamas, then, yeah, we'd probably be a lot better off, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, oh, God.
I mean, I can only speak from my experience. I mean, I've had experience with the Australian government. It wasn't very pleasant. And I've had experience with Hamas, and it was far more pleasant. I like Hamas bickies far more than I like the bickies the Australian government didn't give me. So
no surprises there.
All I can do is speak from my own experience. And I'm not saying Hamas are good guys. All I'm saying is I can only speak from my own experience.
Yeah.
I dwell on it because I want that juxtaposition in people's minds of, you know, how Hamas is constantly sort of presented, if you like, or, you know, alluded to and referred to in the mainstream media versus, you know, your personal experience with them, which is diametrically opposed and then some. I think it's important to break down these you know, brainwashing programs that we've got running. And, you know, hopefully maybe there's one or two people listening who, you know, the next time they hear the word Hamas, they won't think of, you know, terrorists and rockets. They'll think of chocolate, strawberry, vanilla wafers.
Well, yeah, maybe they will. I don't know. But it was a weird thing. I mean, these were kind of, you know, just, you know, regular guys that I came across. I mean, it was a bit, there was some wild elements there. I mean, there always is in any of these places. When we sort of went into the compound, there was kind of a strange-looking guy there who let us in. But, I mean, you know, these are just Arabic guys in Arabic places, and Arabic's a very angry-sounding language. You know,
yeah.
So you never know whether these people are angry with you or not. They just sound like they're angry. But it's just an angry language, angry-sounding language, you know. But they were very good to me. They were very kind, considering I'd broken into their country illegally. And you think about it, the last stamp on my passport said Egypt. So they could have shot me, thrown me over the border, and no one would have known. As far as the world would have known, I died in Egypt. They could have done anything they wanted.
Yeah.
They could have used me as a hostage. They could have done anything they wanted. I was in their country illegally. I was completely at their mercy. And they were very kind to me. And they let me go. And they were kind of, when I spoke at the university, I did all sorts of stuff while I was in there. And you know, they were just nice people. The ones that I met, they were just nice people, just like everybody else that I met around the world. You know, nice people caught in a pretty desperate situation, you know.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. You know, the futility of the situation from our point of view, sitting and watching, I mean, there's only so much you can do besides ranting and raving and telling people and Facebooking about it and all this sort of stuff. It's, you know, you wonder what more we can do to make a material difference in the lives of these people and, you know, end this absurd situation.
We're going to go over there next week and make a documentary and hopefully show people a little bit of the real side of what's going on in Gaza Strip. So, yeah, it'd be interesting. It'd be interesting to see if I can get back into the country after I go over there. What's this? How is new laws? Is it illegal for me to go to Gaza now? I don't know what he's doing with his laws. I mean, I don't know what all this stuff that he's bringing in means. But apparently there's certain places we're not allowed to go to now or something. So, I don't know.
Interesting. Or you'll be painted as a terrorist for going there.
Well, I hope not, because I'm not, but I'm going to go there.
And make a
documentary. I'm going to go there and I'm going to make a documentary about these people, because I think the world needs to hear their story. You know, kind people. The people that I met over there were kind, generous people, and they're being terribly neglected by the rest of the world. And Israel isn't just to blame. I mean, the rest of the world is as well. The rest of the world has just turned their back on these people for so long now. You know, so long. It's disgraceful. We just kind of, you know, turn our back on them and hope they'll go away. You know, but they're not going to go away. They're not going to go away. And if we don't pay attention to it, in the way of Palestine, we're the way of the world. I've said that so many times. And it will. We have to pay attention to it. And so I'm going to go in. I'm going to find this little girl, Noor, that I met in there last time. I want to bring her story to the world. And I want to show the world just how much it's changed since I was in there last time. Show the world what these people have to deal with every day. You know, we have to pay attention to it. We really do. I think it's important.
Can you, when you say, you know, if we don't clean this up in Palestine, that the rest of the world's going to go in that direction, maybe you could elaborate on that for people.
Well, what we see in Palestine is a mechanism for warehousing and surplusing human beings. These people have basically been discarded. I mean, their country's been taken, they've been dispossessed. These are non-people. And when you become a non-person, I mean, There's other situations that are happening around the world as well. The situation in Rwanda, the situation in Panama. There's a situation happening on the border of the United States where there are Mexicans and people who are illegal immigrants who are being taken over the border and basically dumped in Tijuana. And they're living in an area which is basically storm drains between the borders of Mexico and America. And there's thousands of people that are living there. America doesn't want them, and Mexico doesn't want them. And they're just prey to the drug gangs and prostitution gangs and whatever. These are non-people. And it's the same in Palestine. This is the dispossession of an entire country, turning an entire country of people into non-humans who have no voice, they have no rights, they have no anything. And this is what we're seeing around the planet. It's a workable model for surplusing and warehousing human beings. And that's what we're going to see in all of our countries. You know, the way they discard the people of Palestine is the way they're discarding the rest of the world. And the weapons that they're using against the people of Palestine, this dime ammunition, these flash-A bombs, white phosphorus, all of this sort of stuff, it shows what they're prepared to use against civilian populations. So if we don't pay attention to this, I mean, this is giving us the opportunity to pay attention. Here's an entire race of people, an entire nation of people being discarded right before our eyes, where we've got a major Western nation, a member of G8, prepared to wage a war against children using the weapons from hell and call them terrorists while they do it because they dare to fight back, you know. So, yeah, it's the way of Palestine will be the way of the world if we don't pay attention. This is what they're prepared to do to people. And we need to look at this. We need to pay attention to it. It's providing us an opportunity to prevent this from happening to the rest of the world. But if we don't, if we're prepared to condone this by allowing it, by simply remaining inactive in the face of this, then, hey, it's coming to a town near you. You know, and there'll be no way to avoid that. Eventually, it will come to a town near you. And we will deserve it because we sat back and did nothing while this was happening right in front of our faces. You know?
Well, the whole process is done on a bigger scale via dehumanization by making these people appear as though they're not people. They're not children, you know, there's nothing to worry about. They're terrorists. They're the bad people. Bomb them. You know, who cares? That's what's purported to be the mainstream view, and it's so sickening.
Well, yeah, and it's happening here. It's been happening here for the last 200 years with the Australian Aboriginal people. They've just sped it up a little bit in Palestine. It's only been happening in Palestine for the last 67 years. It's taken 200 to do it to the people of this country. But it's the same thing. It's just terra nullis. They came here, no people here. Oh, there were no people living here. Same as Palestine. There were no people living in Palestine. Where's the government they had? No government, no people.
Mm.
Same thing. You know, the Australian Aboriginal people, this is one of the reasons why I have such an affinity with the people of Palestine, because of the people of my own country. The stuff that's happened to the Aboriginal people of this country, it's been absolutely shocking. It's the same thing. Ethnic cleansing, depopulation, the same thing. And it's just been done over a longer period of time, you know. But the people of this country, they've been brutalized by this government, absolutely brutalized. And they're non-people. They don't care about these people at all. You know, it's absolutely shocking. The state of the Aboriginal people of this country. And these people have been completely dispossessed. It's the same thing. And they just came and set up this nation. Same as what Israel did. Just came and set up a nation. Squeezed everybody out. That's exactly what England did when they came to Australia. They just come and set up this nation called Australia and squeezed all the other people out. The Aboriginal people don't call this place Australia. It's just country. It's not Australia. Yeah. Australia is a British word. Yeah, and what is Australia? The AU, gold. It's a corporation for the Southern Adjunct for gold. It's a gold mine. That's what the whole place was set up to be. That's what the word means, you know. But it's the same thing. Yeah. It's the same thing as what's going on in Palestine. And that's why I have such an affinity with it. Because the Palestine, I mean, it's on a world scale. The whole world can pay attention to that. They'll pay attention to that quicker than they'll pay attention to the plight of the Australian Aboriginal. because that's just the state of the world. But it's right there. It's right there in everybody's face. Maybe if we can heal what's going on over there, maybe we can heal this here as well.
Do you say that as actually being the more plausible scenario in the end? healing overseas first before we turn our eyes back to our own shores?
Well, you look, I've tried to get the people of Australia motivated. But, you know, apathralia, what can you do? They're a pretty apathetic bunch. Now, I love them, but they're pretty apathetic. And you've got 26 million people spread out in an area twice the size of Europe. You know, and 26 million people, this isn't even one European city, you know.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to get to the people. I thought, well, it's such a small population, it'd be easy to wake them up. But they're so spread out, it's difficult to get to them all. And they don't really care about anything that isn't in their backyard. And their backyard is 10,000 acres half the time. So, I mean, you know, it's very difficult to wake these people up. So, I mean, I'm into doing it wherever we can make a difference. Sure, if we can make a difference here, yeah, I'll do it. Whatever you think will work. I thought fracking would work. It doesn't seem to have, but I thought it would. I thought if we can't wake the Australian people up with a threat to the groundwater, then what can we use? Because, I mean, this is a spread nation. But it didn't really work. It didn't really wake them up. So I don't know. I mean, try anything. Anywhere we can. Anywhere we can put focus on, anywhere on the planet to wake people up, I'm all for it. So I'll support anything anywhere. But Palestine is something, I mean, it's been in our faces ever since I was a kid. I've heard about Gaza Strip ever since I was 4 or 5 years old, hearing this name in the news. And so perhaps if we can wake the world up to the real situation over there, perhaps it will make a difference, you know. But having gone over there and met the people there, I mean, I have to do something. I can't do nothing because they have no voice. They don't have any international media. They don't have anything. They're just locked away from the rest of the world, and nobody seems to be paying attention to them. The world's calling them terrorists, but they're not. They're just desperate people looking for a way out. They just want to live like the rest of the world. You know, that's all. And they deserve to. They deserve to have the same rights as everybody else. So, having gone and met them and seeing how kind and beautiful these people are and seeing how they have no voice, I feel obligated to be one for them, you know? I think if you went over there, you'd feel the same. It really struck me, just the strength and resilience of these people and the gentleness and the almost childlike nature of these people, it just really struck me, it really got to me. And the fact that they have no voice, it really affected me. And I just have to be one for them as much as I can.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people are cheering you on for that. I'm personally very, very grateful for that. And, you know, if I had the means, you know, to travel over there and do that, I'd have to look at doing it because, you know, it's a frustrating experience sitting and watching from afar while these people are just decimated. But like you say, it's happening. It's been happening for 200 years here, and we're trying to deal with that as well and rectify the situation. And the whole thing's a real mess. And I don't think the average person has much of an idea of, you know, they don't realize that there are dots to be connected here. They see everything happening, you know, Israel, Palestine. That's an isolated sort of conflict. And you know, what's happened in Australia to the original tribes, that's an isolated incident. No one sort of connects the dots, but I personally don't see any of these as being isolated. I see them all as being strands in a much larger web of global control.
Well, yeah, they are. They very much are. And, see, people think the world is a lot bigger than what it really is, you know. I mean, it's really not. The world's quite a small place, you know, and it's all connected. The whole thing's connected. And I don't know, people should get out and travel more, I think. They really should. Get out and see the place for themselves. there's not much to it, really, when you get out there and you look at the world. It's not this big, wide world. It's actually quite a small little community. You know, a lot of people that are kept disconnected from each other. But really, it's a little community, really. 7 billion might seem like a lot of people, but it's not. It's a small community. That's what I found anyway. You know, everywhere I've gone, I've found that people are just the same. They might speak different languages, they might look a little different, but basically they're all the same. They all want something better, you know. And we have an opportunity to do that now. We do. We have a real opportunity for it. I mean, never before in history have we had the workings of the mechanism laid so bare. Never before in history have we've been able to see how controlled we actually are. And that's given us a huge opportunity to do something about it. And when we realize that it is really a small community we've got here, it's not this big wide world. It's actually a small community of people who never really grew up. You know, it's a very childlike world. You know, I found people are childlike everywhere I go. You know, they may pretend to be grown up to a certain degree, but there's always that in a child. There's a certain innocence to most people, and we need to really step back and look at that. I think when we can, we'll change things. You know, but it's not this big, confusing, thing that we think it is. It's actually a small community, and if we can learn to respect each other, we'll change things. I think the whole thing comes down to respect. That's where the solution lies. Everything comes down to this loss of respect. That's why we're in this situation that we're in. We don't respect ourselves enough to respect other people. And that's what we've got here. I mean, we're waking up to this. The world's waking up. It's an incredibly important time to be alive. I really think it is. More than any other time in history, I think this is a really important time to be here. And we're all making a difference. And I'm glad to be here. I really am. I think it's wonderful to be here, to be part of it all.
I agree.
Yeah, I think it's a bigger responsibility to be here at this point in history, because everyone alive drawing breath right now is responsible for taking action towards the transformation of a planet that's been torn apart and desecrated. Or, you know, choosing not to take action, then, you know, really not taking action is still a form of action. So we're all responsible. We're all in this boat of responsibility together as sovereigns, whether we realize we're sovereign or not. And we all really need to be active and unified. I think what you said about the childlike nature of people is really pertinent as well, because when people get stuck in the matrix and start pretending to be grown-ups and adults and they lose touch with their inner child, I think that is a huge contributor, or I'm losing the words to express what I was thinking, but it's when they lose touch with their own inner child. If you look at a child, they're a source, they're a fount of intuitive and instinctual compassion and empathy. And when you lose touch with that own inner child, then you lose your ability to access that childlike, you know, those childlike virtues, and that's where we end up being divided against one another, because we end up living these sort of artificial lives in our little minds, in our little programmed boxes, and we no longer feel like we're connected and attached, and that it is a small community anymore. We're all out for ourselves and trying to survive and pay the bills and all this sort of nonsense.
Well, I think that it's always there. The inner child's always there. It's just that we try to ignore it. We really don't like to face it. Mm-hmm. And many people don't like to face it. They don't like to admit that it's there. They don't like to admit that they're vulnerable in any way. They don't like to admit that they're human. It's all about being a machine, being the persona that they've constructed for themselves. Most people construct a persona for themselves which is based on what they own, or what they believe where they believe themselves to be on the particular rungs on the social or economic ladder. Okay, this is me. Here I am. I look like this. This is my symbol. This is who I am, you know. And that's what they present to the world. It's what they present to their wife, to their spouse, to their family. And they don't really like to admit that they're actually a human being, a person with feelings, and they cry, and they do all the stuff that other people do, and they care, you know. They don't like to admit that because it's a weakness. You know, to care is to be weak. You don't want to care. I mean, look at the elite. They go do this ceremony every year, the cremation of care, you know.
Yeah.
This is how strong they are, you know. So that people don't like to admit these human qualities about themselves because we don't have a society which exalts humanity or wants to give any credence or tribute or respect to human qualities. It's all about being successful in the eyes of the business or economic or social model. So we've lost this part of ourselves, but it's in there with everybody. People just don't like to admit that it's there because they're programmed not to admit that it's there. They're programmed to see it as a weakness, you know. But again, it's programming. It's all to do with programming. But it's in there in everybody. Everybody has it, whether they like to
admit
it or not. They do have it, and they call it even calling it the inner child. Oh, we've got to respect our inner child, you know. This is a whole new age yuppie way of looking at it. It's just, this is part of me that's human. This is what you're calling the inner child, the part of me that cares, you know, or the real part of me. This is the inner child, is it? So it's in that little box now, you know what I'm saying? A program, you know, so.
Yeah.
I mean, these human qualities are part of all of us. It's called being alive, you know. And we don't want to admit our aliveness, if you will. We just don't want we don't want to acknowledge it. We want to be what this economic and social system tells us we should be. We want to be what that success story on the TV is. We want to be like that guy on the screen or that woman on the screen or this picture in the magazine. You know, we've forgotten that what we're supposed to be is us, you know?
Absolutely.
I feel
like it's, we've got two constructs in our society, and because we're so set up to, around fear and around that way of living and being, that humanness that's within us, that is meant to drive our moral compass that we're meant to live by, that natural law that's within us that we know right from wrong. We can't follow that in the construct of today's system, the way that it's set up, because if we do, we end up in trouble. We are the weird person. We are the person who's going out on a limb being the alternative. It's so programmed that we are thinking and being that capitalistic, materialistic person, because if we do care, we are the minority.
You can't care and be successful in the eyes of the machine.
Yeah.
In the eyes of the social system. But really, what is success? I mean, I consider myself to be very successful, and I have nothing and live in a shed. So, but I consider myself to be really successful because I'm very successful at being me. I'm very successful of expressing the art of myself and the art of my life. I know who I am. You know, I've got flaws. I don't pretend to be perfect, but I know who I am, and I'm successful at that, and I'm comfortable with myself. I don't have any expectations of myself. I don't pretend that I'm something that I'm not. I don't judge myself as being anything other than what I am. You know, so, I mean, I believe I have a unique perspective that is unique to me. I mean, it's the same as everybody else. Your perspective is unique to you. And this is valid, and it's valuable. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. So, you know, I just sort of, I'm an observer through life, and I think I'm very successful at being an observer. And I think that's what I'm here to do. I think that's what we're all here to do. It's not about accumulating all this stuff because you can't take it with you anyway. This is just a short experience. You're here for the blink of an eye, you know, in the cosmic scheme of things. So it's having that stake in the outcome that people have and that judgment of themselves. I don't have any of that. So I think I'm successful. I'm successful because I'm successful at expressing the art of myself. And that's what we're here to do. And people don't do that. They don't express the art of themselves. They go through life and they become successful at accumulating material wealth, but they end up never knowing themselves, you know, and that's a terrible thing. It's a sad thing. I mean, I've met people, even at Jeff's seminars, who have given up everything they owned and just given away all their possessions and sold their businesses and paid off everybody and just got a backpack and gone off around the world and been happier than they've ever been because they finally discovered themselves. They realized it wasn't about all this stuff. All this stuff is just stuff that's there to distract you from being yourself. So, you know, it's about your perspective, really. It's about your perspective and about what you do with this time. Don't have a stake in the outcome. You're only here for a little while. Make sure you experience yourself while you're here because that's a big part of it, you know.
What else is there if you're not going to experience yourself and tap into that and that the potential and the creative potential there? I'd say you're missing out on a fair bit.
Well, yeah, you are, and a lot of people do. They miss out on themselves because they judge themselves by all this stuff that isn't themselves. It's all this external shit. I think that's who they are. That's what they are. But they're not, you know.
Yeah, I mean, were you going to say something? I was just going to say, before when you made that great observation about the, you know, the inner child just being another concept and another category, and, you know, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, what does the inner child represent if not wonderment, playfulness, you know, the joie de vivre, you know, that all those vital, you know, life affirming attributes. That's what we're really referring to. And so many people, when they start playing that corporate game, that matrix game, that get ahead, survival of the fittest, Darwinian sort of nonsense, you know, they lose that part of themselves. And I think that, you know, that what you say about mastering the art of being yourself is so pertinent. And I think it's such a, like, the time has never been more ripe for people to hear that kind of sentiment, because we really desperately need people to step into themselves and work out what it is that really lights their fire and inspires them, because that's coming back into the world of the living. That's what touches people and awakens other people and transforms the planet, not getting a bigger paycheck.
Well, yeah, I mean, the art of yourself, I mean, really, I view each person as being an artistic expression of creation. I mean, the art of you yourself, it's art. It's all art, you know. I mean, you're an artistic expression of creation. The way you walk, the way you talk, the way you move, the way you interact with people, the way you dress, the way you eat, the way you do the things you do, the way you be you. This is art. This is an artistic expression of creation. And just being aware of that, being aware of your uniqueness, is an incredible thing. And seeing it in other people, seeing the uniqueness of each person, seeing each person is having a completely unique perspective and being completely unique in themselves and being an art form in themselves. It isn't that the art of expressing yourself or the art of knowing yourself, it's knowing that you yourself are art. You are an art form in itself. That's the beauty of it. Yeah? And that's the wonderment of it. And that when you start to see that in yourself, it's fantastic. It really is. It just changes your perspective of what reality is and what you are and how you can interact with other people. Now, when you see this in yourself and you see this validity in yourself, you start to see it in other people and you start to see other people as being an artistic expression of creation. Everybody is. Everybody is their own art form in themselves. And it's a wonderful thing. And that's the way I look at things. That's the way I look at myself. It's the way I look at other people. And it's an incredible understanding to have, because life itself is art. And when we begin to realize that and begin to express life as art, I think that's when things will change, you know. I mean, it certainly changed for me. When I started to live my life this way, things really, really started to change for me. And I don't get it right all the time. And even when I say all this stuff, people say, oh, wow, this sounds so great, like a real guru, you know. Well, I'm not a guru. I mess up as much as everybody else, you know. But it's just having this understanding that it's okay to mess up. That's how we learn. It's okay to do the wrong thing sometimes, because then you learn to do the right thing. You know, it's when you don't learn that's when the problem happens. You know, but it's okay to mess up, and it's okay not to be perfect by these parameters that have been given to you by this system, because this system's completely flawed. You're perfect at being you, and that's what's perfect about it, and that's all you really need to do is to be you. But to know what you are and to know who you are and to know that it's all about art, you know. It's a big thing for me anyway. It's really changed a lot of things for me, having this perspective. And I think it helps, you know. So that's what I try to share with people.
Well, I think that's gold. The view of yourself as art itself is beautiful. I mean, that's a huge paradigm shift for people, and probably very, you know, really potentially inspiring. I mean, if you see yourself as art, then by definition, literally everything you do is a work of art. I mean, you're constantly in a creative flow at that point. I mean, that's not a way that a lot of people see themselves. A lot of people don't see themselves as being creative at all.
Well, they don't. They don't. They misconstrue what being creative is. They don't realize that life itself is creative. The fact that you're here is creative, you know? The fact that you're here, the fact that you've got this outfit that you put on today, and you've dressed yourself the way you do, and you speak the way you do, and you eat the way you do, and you walk the way you do. This is all creative. The whole lot of it is creative. The fact that you are here experiencing life from the perspective that is you is creative in itself. You know, that is art in itself. You don't have to be artistic to be art. You are art. Simply by being alive, you're art.
Exactly.
You don't have to do anything. You just be, and you are. And that's the beauty of that. I love that perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's good. It works.
Everything's an action.
Well, yeah, and it works. It's true, you know. And it changes the way you look at other people as well, you know. You're not so judgmental of people when you can look at people this way. But you're not going to get that until you learn to look at yourself that way, you know.
And that's what a lot of people are afraid to do. When all that external stuff is taken away, they are really, truly afraid to look within and see who they actually are, because they've never known that. Some people get to their deathbed before they realize that it's too late.
Well, they look at themselves in the mirror and they look at them and they go, oh, wow, that's me. Gee, I don't look like that person in that magazine, and I don't have this stuff that I thought I needed, and oh my god, I don't look like what these people do on the TV. How am I ever going to be accepted by my peers? How am I ever going? It's all these other ideas, all these parameters that are given to them by other people, all these parameters that are given to them by the social system or the economic system or whatever, which is caused them to judge themselves poorly, and they don't see their own uniqueness and their own perfection. Don't ever see that this whole perspective is completely unique to them, and that no one else can ever have that, and it's what they do with that and what they do with that information, how they interact with the world around them from the unique perspective that they've got. That's what's important. They don't see any of that, because all they're doing is judging themselves as not being successful or not being beautiful or not being this or not being that, which is all other people's parameters. There's nothing that was ever them. I mean, if you didn't have a mirror and you didn't have a fashion magazine and you didn't have a clock to know how old you were, how old would you be? If you didn't have any concept of what beauty was, why would you judge yourself as not being beautiful if you didn't have some magazine to measure yourself up to? But I'll have to say to people, if you didn't know how old you were, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you were? Right? I love to say that to people. and they don't know how to answer it, you know. It's all other people's ideas and other people's parameters. It's all other people's concepts of what beauty is, of what success is, of what life is, of what you should be. Well, what about what you are? What about that? Did you ever stop to think about that and get rid of all the noise that comes from other people and just look at yourself from your own unique perspective and experience that? Because that's a unique thing, and that's what you're here to experience, and that's what you're missing out on because there's all of this other shit going on. All this other noise that's out there telling you you need to be like this and look like this and do this and meet these standards and do all this other rubbish, which has all been constructed for you. It's not you, you know. And that's the problem, you know. And we've lost that. We've lost that. So once we can really step back and start to look at what we are and realize that, hang on, if I'm this unique, perfect perspective, well, that means everybody else is as well. And suddenly all the barriers break down between people and we're not judging each other anymore and suddenly everything's good. You know, you start to look at yourself this way and shit, where's the problem? Where's the problem with other people?
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with anyone. You know, I have disagreements with them, I have arguments with them, but I don't have a problem with them. You know? So, you know, don't have problems with people, don't have problems with yourself. You know? Look at yourself, learn yourself, understand yourself, realize what you are. It's a unique thing. Don't miss out on that because you're too busy trying to work things out from other people's perspectives. You know, don't miss out on yourself.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the whole, you know, I guess, you know, there may be a sense of irony in there somewhere that the world of advertising, as you just briefly alluded to a moment ago, it, you know, kind of ironically uses art in order to homogenize us and lead us away from our own source of internal art so that we all buy the same purse or, you know, the same dress or the same shoes and all this garbage. It's all about the external reference points for self-expression, and that's where we, you know, you lose the self, obviously, because, like you say, you're operating in someone else's parameters and someone else's game.
Well, yeah, you do, and you're trained through this system never to find yourself to begin with, you know. Look, you never really discover it through this system. This system is designed to lead you anywhere but there, you know. You've got the whole scholastic system. It's definitely not designed to lead you to yourself, you know, anywhere but.
No.
Well, what would happen if we were led to ourselves would be that, you know, we would realize that color, race, religion, creed, any of those constructs that are all made up do not matter, and there would be there would be no conflict. There would be just this recognition that we are all one, and we all are all the same. We are united.
Yeah, that wouldn't work very well for the system, would it?
No, God, no.
That don't work.
The world would fall apart.
It would.
And it would be so beautiful.
Well, yeah, it would be a lot better than what we've got. But hey, look, you know, what we've got's pretty good. I mean, I think it's a pretty amazing time to be here because we've got all this information now, all this knowledge now, and we're waking up. You know, we're waking up to the control grid. We're waking up to the power that we've got. So, you know, in a way, we've already won. The battle's already won. This is just how we do it, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we had to come this far. We had to see what we've seen, feel what we've felt in order to wake up to the fact that this is not going to work moving forward. And, I mean, it's like they say you need the darkness to see the light, and I feel like that's where we're coming to now is that light, and people waking up is a major part of that. And, you know, even just our show and the work that you're doing is a symbol of that, the growth that is coming in the every month, you know, every week. the people that are flocking towards learning this information and discovering the control system and the matrix and all the stuff that's happening, the truth about money and consciousness and every single thing that we're interested in. There's people yearning for this information and looking to go within, because the option that was once there is no longer an option. They're not willing to settle for that anymore.
Well, they don't really have a choice. I mean, it's getting pretty dark out there. I mean, if people don't wake up and start paying attention soon, we're not going to have much of a future. I mean, in a way, I mean, it's self-fulfilling. They don't really have a choice. They have to wake up. People are going to have to wake up to this control grid and wake up to what's going on in the world, or they won't have a future. It's as simple as that. So, I mean, yeah, they have to. I mean, I think the job, I mentioned to someone recently on an interview, the job of the alternative media now really is to provide a safety net for people so that when people do wake up to the way the world is run, they see that there's a way out. They see that there is other options. You know, just going to fear, just going to paranoia and violent revolution, you know. They realize there's a way out, you know. So it's all opportunity. All of these problems provide us with opportunities. I think it's just important for us to see that. But there is opportunity in all trauma, in all drama. There's opportunity, you know, all problems, anything like this that we face, it's all opportunity. So that's what we have to see, and that's what we have to embrace, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And we agree with that too. I mean, with every guest we have on, we always attempt to focus on what the solution is, because there are so many people and sites out there that are focusing on the bad and the fear, and although it's an alternative viewpoint, it's still providing that same fear-based feeling for people. It's not positive. It's not working towards the future, whereas we like to think about what can we do individually to create this heaven on earth, because it's up to us. It's not up to anyone else.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a lot to fear. There is a lot coming down the pipe that is not good. There is a lot to be feared. But again, it provides opportunity for us. I mean, you got to see what the problem is before you can address the problem. So, you know, you got to look at all of this and not say, well, I don't want to focus on the negative. You've got to look at the negative, but see it as opportunity. You know, all these problems do exist and there is a lot to fear. But it's all opportunities for us to find remedy for it. It's all opportunities for us to fix the problem. So, you know, you can't ignore it. But don't just go into fear and hide away and think you can't do anything. Because you can. Even by having these shows and doing what you're doing, it makes a difference. All these things make a difference, you know. So be aware that the shadow's there. Don't turn your back on it. We have to face it. But don't do it from a state of fear and disempowerment. I do it from a state of concern rather than fear. I mean, concern leads to positive action. You know, you tend to cower away in fear. But concern, you're concerned for something, so you leads to positive action. You want to fix it. So, well, I'm concerned for the future, but I'm not in fear of it, you know. I don't have a stake in the outcome either. In anything that I do, I don't have any stake in the outcome. Like, if humankind is going to destroy itself, then it destroys itself. I prefer that it didn't, because I can see the potential we have for something far greater than the direction that we're going. And that's why I do what I do. But not because I have fear that we won't survive. If we don't survive, well, we don't survive. The experiment fails. It doesn't concern me. I won't be here. You know, it doesn't matter. What matters is that I do something positive with the time that I've got allotted to me, and that's why I do what I do. I do what I do because I can see the potential that we've got, you know, and I think it would be a shame to squander that potential. And so that way I don't really have a stake in the outcome if we fail. If we fail, we fail. I prefer if we didn't, but if we do, we do. That's just the way it goes, you know. But I'll do what I can to hopefully ensure that we don't, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what it's all about. And it sounds like you've got a fairly healthy state of non-attachment there, constructive non-attachment, might I say. I'm just aware that we're going to have to start wrapping up, mate, but did you want to say anything more about the documentary that you're going to be starting when you do get to Gaza again?
Well, the film I'm going to be making is called Finding Noor. I want to make a film about this little girl that I met when I was in there last time. Like I said, I'm pretty sure she's alive, but I want to make a film about the journey that it's taking me to go back and find her. I'm also working on a documentary about the Amazon rainforest that I want to finish as well, which will be used to launch the Full Circle project, which is going to be launched next year. And this is a big project which will involve workshops right around the place, trying to re-educate people into how to deal with government and create some sort of a template we can use to be able to, you know, continue these workshops everywhere we go and some sort of a platform people can use to deal with their situation locally, you know. That's what I want to try to do with that. So I've got all sorts of stuff on the burner. But, yeah, I've got to get back on the air soon as well. I've got the radio show. I've got to continue doing that. So I got so much on. But hopefully I'll have Finding Noor released by the end of the year, and I'll have the documentary about the Amazon released by the middle of next year, and I'll have Full Circle Project fully up and running by early next year as well. So that's the plan. I got a lot on, but that's the plan, you know.
So much to do.
And do you have a way that people may be able to contribute to helping you get these projects completed and out there?
Look, I've got a donate button on the website. If people can contribute, sure. It would be great. I really do need some help at the moment. But there is a website called fullcirclenow.net. You can contribute through that, or you can contribute through the donate link on the Crow House. It all gets to me, and it's all used basically for the same things. It's all used to, I'm putting a lot of it into the Full Circle Project and this trip to Gaza and making this film about Noor and just doing what I can to get information to people. So yeah, any contributions people can make would be greatly appreciated. So that's basically the way people can help me do what I do and continue to do it.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, well, we definitely encourage everyone to jump on the websites there and do just that.
It doesn't matter how much you've got, guys. Just if you've got anything that you can donate and contribute to this cause, it's such an important message that we need to get out to the world to share these stories from a human perspective so that people can understand what's actually truly going on. So even if it's a dollar, 50 cents, whatever you can contribute, I'm sure Max will greatly appreciate your contribution.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really needed at the moment. So, yeah, anything you can would be great.
Awesome. Beautiful. Well, mate, you've been on fire for us tonight, and we want to thank you again for joining us and sharing this hour and three quarters-ish with us. And I'm sure we'll speak again in future and all the best with those projects and getting them up and running.
And safe travels to Gaza.
Yeah, thanks guys. It'll be good. I'm looking forward to going back there and seeing everybody, and thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
It's our pleasure, mate. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks very much, everyone. That was Max Egan, Australian activist and researcher, writer and all sorts. Really good guy. And God knows that I'm all for funding his humanitarian and educational activities pertaining to Gaza. Absolutely. I mean, you know, everyone, all the bloody planet's governments are funding Israel's terrorist activities in Gaza. The least we can do is try and counterbalance that to some small extent. And also just regarding next week's show, guys, again, we're on a different platform next week. The link there is that you'll need to go to is globalfreedommovement.org/radio. It's no longer going to be the blog talk platform.
Hallelujah.
And yeah, we've got Rick Strassman on next week. That's going to be fantastic. Also, we want to encourage you to donate to the GFM project to help us stay up and running and do what we do.
It's amazing getting contributions from everyone who's listening. It really does benefit us and allow us to continue the work that we do. We've got a buy now button on all the archives now, so as you listen to the replay, if you feel that you've gained a lot from listening to the guest, we always recommend that if you are financially able, we greatly appreciate anything you can offer.
Absolutely. It all goes to some pretty worthy activities and totally, what's the word I'm looking for? Totally, not honest, but, well, it is honest.
It
but
is.
A cause based in integrity, really.
Integrity,
that's,
authenticity.
That's where we're operating from.
Yeah, it's what we live for.
That's it, and we know a lot of you guys know us personally, so you know what we're on about and who we are. Mm. So we want to thank you again for your support, and we'll look forward to seeing you next Sunday night at 9 p.m. on the new platform, guys. Have an amazing week. We hope you enjoyed Max, and we will see, in inverted commas, you again then.
Thanks so much for joining us, guys, and we'll see you next week.
Ciao for now.
Freedom, disclosure, equality, consciousness. You're on GFN Radio with Brendan Murphy and the GFN crew, and you are the global freedom movement.